We would love for you to spread the word about the 1A podcast. So tap the share button in your podcast app, text a friend, maybe tell someone in person, but however you do it, it really does help us out. You can also, of course, leave us a rating and a review in the Apple Podcasts app. Thanks. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. As the world danced in the new year, the U.S. was also partying like it's 1923. Dancing in your seat, aren't you? 1923 was the year that James P. Johnson, no relation, composed a jazz hit inspired by the dance The Charleston. At midnight on this New Year's Day, The Charleston entered the public domain, along with an array of other songs, films, and books from 1923. That means no more copyright penalties or fees for anyone who wants to use them. Now, this is the first time in more than 20 years that works have been added to the U.S. public domain. So what else is in this treasure trove? And what could we do with it? And how do our copyright laws protect, or limit, creators? Joining us from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, are Jennifer Jenkins and James Boyle. They're both professors at Duke's School of Law who specialize in intellectual property. Jennifer is also the director of the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke. Professor Jenkins, welcome to 1A.
Hi, Joshua. Thanks so much for having us.
And Professor Boyle, welcome.
Please call me Jennifer.
Jennifer, of course. And Professor Boyle, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I will call you James. Let's get some basics down. First of all, Jennifer, what exactly is public domain? What does that mean?
Material in the public domain means that the copyrights have expired. And so those works are free for anyone to use and build upon.
And James, on the flip side, what exactly is a copyright?
Copyright is the legal right which the states around the world have created to protect expressive creative works. So think movies, songs, books. And those works, if they are fixed in material form and they are actually creative, independently created, modicum of creativity, they are protected for a term which has been getting longer and longer over time.
How long is a copyright, James?
Right now, were you to write something, you get your entire life and then 70 years after your death. If you're a corporation, then you get 95 years.
So, Jennifer, if I went home today and at home wrote a short story about a little boy and his dog who go on a magical adventure, the moment I hit save on that file, it's copyrighted?
That's exactly right. The moment it's fixed in a tangible medium of expression. And you sound young and sprightly, Joshua. So say you live another 60 years. That means whatever you write during your lifetime will be copyrighted from 130 years from today, 60 years plus 70 years after your death.
James Boyle, why is copyright and why is public domain such a big deal?
Well, I think the public domain is the half of the copyright system. We want to encourage people to create, and let's be clear, Jennifer and I are really in favor of authors and creators and musicians getting a reward. We want to encourage that. We also want those works to be accessible, both for us to enjoy and for other people to build upon. And we know that their commercial value is exhausted pretty quickly. For most books, for most music, after 20 years, it's extremely unlikely that the work has any commercial value left. And after 130, practically none. So we want the copyright to sort of taper off, making the works more available both for the public but also for future creators to build on.
Oh, by the way, James, just for grammatical purposes, because this is NPR and I will get tweets, is it copyrighted or copywritten?
It's copyrighted.
Thank
it is copyrighted. And thanks to all of the NPR grammar Nazis out there. I like the fact that, you know, someone is keeping us to our grammatical
people
tasks.
Pay attention, and I don't want to get those angry tweets. So copyrighted. Jennifer, is everything copyrighted? I mean, I work for WAMU, which produces 1A. So the things that I am saying right now are creative, but they don't belong to me. I am presenting what's called a work for hire. So I understand that this broadcast is not my copywritten work. It belongs to American University, which owns WAMU. But is every single thing that anyone creates instantly copyrighted? Are there things that are just public domain by their nature?
That's a great question, Joshua. So as you mentioned, works made for hire are copyrighted by corporate authors. They get the 95 years. But any copyrighted work the facts in a copyrighted work, the ideas in the copyrighted work, the stock elements in the copyrighted work, those go immediately into the public domain. No one owns those because it would be impossible for anyone else to create or for you as a journalist to report without having free access to the facts and ideas and stock elements of a book or a movie or a piece of music. And so there are elements within copyrighted works that go immediately into the public domain, even though the original creative expression encasing that material is subject to copyright.
So if I was a guest and we were talking philosophy and I was describing some new philosophy that I had, the broadcast of 1A is copyrighted by WAMU, American University, NPR. They have their arrangement for who owns the broadcast. But the idea that I convey within it, they don't own. That's public domain.
That's exactly true. So say, you know, hypothetically speaking, someone thinks that building the wall isn't really necessary and not going to do any good. That idea goes immediately into the public domain, even though the way that you express that idea is protected. And you're in D.C. Works of the federal government, there's a special section in the Copyright Act that says those are all in the public domain. So any official work of the U.S. government is not subject to copyright protection under U.S. law.
So James, we heard a little bit of the Charleston. Tell us about some of the other works that are now in the public domain as of this New Year's Day. Are there any in particular that you're most excited about or that you think are the most culturally significant?
Well, I have a weird mixture of highbrow and lowbrow tastes. I'm particularly excited by the silent films and particularly the physical comedy in the silent films. We've got stuff from Charlie Chaplin, The Pilgrim. We've got Buster Keaton's Our Hospitality. We've got Safety Last, which is those people who have maybe seen the iconic scene of Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock. Always looks like he's about to fall. And I'm really excited by those because now I think more people will see those and they'll realize that given the limitations of this medium, these films were silent, these people had to convey everything using their bodies, right? You couldn't use sound. And that what you saw as a result was an incredible explosion of creativity in physical comedy. And whoever your favorite physical comic is, whether it's, you know, John Cleese or Jacques Tati or whomever, you can see in their work the roots of this original stuff. And that's just one example of how our culture constantly loops back and builds on what went before.
Now, Jennifer, before I get to some of your favorites, I'm just going to search online. Harold Lloyd Safety, if I can spell safety, last search. Okay, so I see it's available on Amazon Prime for $3. It's on iTunes for $4. Some people on YouTube have posted it online. James, it appears that I can already go online and access Harold Lloyd Safety Last, either if I choose to pay for it or for free. What difference does it make now that it's in the public domain? I mean, I could see it on New Year's Eve. Now, what difference does it make now after New Year's Day?
So that's a great question, and should this radio host thing not work out for you, you should consider law school.
We'd love to have you too. Don't tell me that! You're trying to destroy my credibility. Don't say that to me.
The answer is first of all, we'd expect the versions of Safety Last to proliferate and the prices to come down, right? This is something that was already available because it was famous, right? So more versions will be there. They will, you know, people may try to colorize it. They may do other things with it, which could not be done before legally, and the price will come down. Also, it will be available in full for free, which it might or might not have been available legally. But the key part is Safety Last is that's the top of the iceberg. That's the tiny percentage of works that actually we still know about that were still commercially viable. The important thing to remember here is that the copyright covers the whole iceberg, including the stuff under the surface, which in this case are all of the works which aren't commercially available, in many cases have literally rotted in their cans, have actually disintegrated because copyright was protecting them. It was illegal to screen them or to digitize them or what have you. But we didn't even know who the author was. We couldn't find them, and there was nothing commercially available. That's all the downsides of copyright. We lock stuff up. With none of the upsides of copyright, we incentivize new creativity.
Jennifer, what about you? Any works that have just been released into the public domain that you're most excited about?
Oh, so many of them. I'm pretty excited about the music. So I've been going on a tear listening to music from 1923. Turns out, not a big fan of the foxtrot, but I am, and I already knew this, a huge fan. It was the dawn of the jazz age, Joshua. And so we have works from, you know, early works from a bright young Louis Armstrong, who's in his early 20s. We have works from Jelly Roll Morton. We have works from the New Orleans Rhythm Kings. We have the Charleston that you just played. The Charleston dance was actually very very controversial back in the 20s. It was kind of like the twerking of the 20s, and that was the raucous music that you did it to. So
the Charleston was the twerking of the 20s. I think that's the
true
quote of the day, for real.
Joshua, women were dancing without men. You know, you could Charleston solo.
So no, you're right.
You know, foxtrot to Charleston, just
you're
swinging
right
your arms and your legs around. It was great. And then a personal favorite, not because it's a good song, but because my grandmother used to sing it off key all the time, was Yes, We Have No Bananas. We Have No Bananas Today.
Here's another song that's in the public domain, Coal Cart Blues by Louis Armstrong, released in 1923. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you are always free to listen to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
I've got those coal cart blues. I'm really all confused. I'm about to lose my very mind. It always worry.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Withings, creator of the Wi-Fi Smart Scale. Meet your goals with a smart scale that delivers weight, BMI, and body composition, even a local weather report. See why Tom's Guide named Withings Body Plus the best overall smart scale of 2018. Visit withings.com/NPR for 30% off any body composition scale. Withings, giving people the tools they need to improve their lives.
Human behavior doesn't always make a ton of sense, at least on the surface.
I said, would you mind if I give the dogs a little piece of cracker with some hot sauce on it and without, and see what they choose?
Hidden Brain, a spicy podcast about science, psychology, and why people do what they do.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're discussing what happens when works of art, film, music, and literature enter the public domain and what can happen when they don't. By the way, because Jennifer brought it up, we figured we'd play a little clip of it for some of you who may be a little too young to remember this song from your youth. Here is the newly entered into the public domain song, Yes, We Have No Bananas.
We've string beans and onions, cabbages and scallions, and all kinds of fruit and say. We have an old-fashioned tomato, a Long Island potato, but yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
What is it to you that is important about being able to hear songs like Yes, We Have No Bananas, this silly little song from the 20s? Like, what's the impact?
Well, two things are important. One thing is, as James mentioned, you can reuse them. So yes, maybe we could hear the song before, but now if you want to write a children's book, you know, teaching your kids about all the different kibbashes and bananas and tomatoes and potatoes, you could use the lyrics of that song as the basis for your illustrated book. But also to what James just mentioned, the works that we're talking about, those works made it. Those works are famous. Those works are among the maybe 1% of works from 1923 that are still commercially available. What's important about the public domain is that the other 99% of works that are no longer marketable, we can make those available now. We can fill in the cultural record. We can put them online, which means that people can rediscover and breathe new life into forgotten works. So, for example, a digital library called HathiTrust, they've just turned on full access to over 53,000 titles from 1923. Most of those books are probably long forgotten. Now you can find them online.
Speaking of the way that artists find these works, Aaron wrote on our website, the1a.org, the university whose choir I sing in was only able to stream half of our major concert last year because we performed Chichester Psalms, which isn't in the public domain. They didn't want to spend the money to buy the rights, so it couldn't be broadcast and the performance couldn't be posted on their site. James, I love Aaron's comment because I have run into this too. The rights to music can get really sticky. And if you get stuck in a copyright case, it can literally destroy your organization if someone decides to kind of grind you for copyright. Even if they don't, it's just so terrifying that some ensembles just choose not to touch anything, particularly if they really, really want to use it.
That's exactly right. And I think it's one of the more unfortunate parts of the current copyright system. Again, we're in favor of artists getting paid. What we have created, unfortunately, is a massive bureaucracy which operates according to a body of law, copyright, which we're talking about. And you're explaining really nicely to your audience, but which most people don't understand. And so frequently they self-censor. So even where they are allowed to do something, one of your questions, I believe, mentioned fair use, people go, oh, no, I'm not allowed to do that. And we get sort of ludicrous stories, which I'd be happy to share you, of people basically disciplining themselves, thinking that copyright doesn't forbid uses, even when it does. And we also have actual cases which are illegal, so that you would think, oh, surely a choir is allowed to do this, or surely, you know, a composer is allowed to take Robert Frost's poem and turn it into an elegiac memorial. This is a real example, which Jennifer can tell you about. And it actually turns out, no, they can't, and that can be prohibited. And that's where copyright isn't necessarily promoting the goal it was supposed to promote, which is creativity.
Jennifer, I wonder if you could respond to some of the folks who are asking about their copyrights, including Erica, who tweeted, I work as a photojournalist and a writer. My photos occasionally pop up where they don't belong. What do I even do in that situation? How does copyright enforcement work?
Well, it works in a number of different ways. One way that you can enforce your copyright is that if your work is still copyrighted, you can send, you know, a letter to the person or entity that has posted it without authorization, explaining that you own the copyright and asking them to take it down. There are also special laws that deal with video sharing sites like YouTube, Vimeo, that create a special notice and takedown procedure that makes it easier to take copyrighted content down when it's been posted without authorization. And Joshua, it's not creators versus the public domain. We said this earlier. The public domain is actually important to creativity because creators draw on the past, right? I mean, try to create anything out of thin air. All of the people who have written in probably used public domain material in creating their own works. So it's not an either or.
Yeah, with regards to that, and particularly the era of the internet, that might get us into another voicemail that landed in our inbox.
Shel Sullivan from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Me and my brothers performed an acoustic version of a Bob Dylan song, and I uploaded it to my YouTube channel. Shortly after, I received an email from YouTube saying that there was a copyright infringement. But the email also said, don't worry, we don't have to take down your video. We're just going to redirect the advertising money made from the video to the musician, which I thought was a clever way to get the actual musicians paid for when their songs are performed on YouTube.
Shel, that is pretty interesting. And Jennifer, this opens up this frontier of the law in terms of cover songs on YouTube, fan fiction, very common ways for kind of people to show their appreciation for different works of art, but they've also kind of opened up new legal challenges too.
Well, so what Shel's talking about, thanks so much for that voicemail, is YouTube has actually created a very clever system on top of the base of copyright law called Content ID. It has its problems, but one of its benefits is that when it works well, it allows works to stay up, to stay available, such as his cover song of Bob Dylan, but also for someone to get paid. And so if you're a copyright owner, you can give YouTube a record of all of your works, and you can choose between different options of what you want if someone posts a version of your work without permission. And an increasing number of music copyright holders have chosen monetization. So what that means is your work stays up, but Bob Dylan or his publisher get money from it.
Before we talk about protections, Jennifer, what is Creative Commons?
You know, I really feel like I should let James talk about this because he was actually one of the founding board members of Creative Commons. So since it was partly his baby, I think I'll let him talk.
James, tell us about your baby. Tell us about Creative Commons.
I was fascinated. I was like, I get to hear what she really thinks about Creative Commons.
Maybe I should make Jennifer answer the question.
Probably good for your listeners and bad for our marriage. So in order to let people individuals, you and me, actually exercise their copyrights. Because the trouble was that copyright system was a basically one-size-fits-all. It was designed around industrial corporations that had printing presses or broadcast towers or movie studios. And it was assumed that this would enable them to have their very expensive lawyers, who we train, get together and make deals. But it wasn't really designed for you or for me or for the person who tweeted you, who actually do want to share their work but also want to retain some degree of control over it. And so Creative Commons basically allows you to make some really simple choices. Do you want to allow people to copy this? Do you want to only allow them to copy it non-commercially? Do you want to allow them to change it? Or do you want it to stay exactly as it is? And do you want to make sure that you get attribution? And you just basically hit a few buttons and get a tool which says, this is the license that I'm giving you the work under. So long as you follow my directions, you're not violating copyright law. And it allows people to exercise their copyright and share in the ways they're comfortable.
And with regards to protecting your work, if it is covered by a Creative Commons license, I imagine, James, that depends on what kind of license you use, right?
It does. I mean, basically it says, you know, you you can use this, but not commercially. So we wrote a casebook. It's available for anyone to download for free, but you're not allowed to go out and publish a competing edition and sell it for money. If you did that, we would have the same remedies as we would always have under copyright. Creative Commons doesn't give you superpowers. It doesn't give me a cape that will allow me to fly to Connecticut Avenue and brace you at the door of 1A and say, "You scoundrel, sir, unhand my book." But it does allow you to fine-grain control the use of your work. And then if the person is infringing, then you do the things that people do when their copyright's infringed. You write nasty grams. You get the work taken down from online platforms. And if all else fails, you bring a lawsuit.
One more question, Jennifer, for Matt, who wrote on our website, the1a.org. Could you have your guest touch on fair use as it applies to classrooms? As a teacher who creates a lot of his own educational materials, this is a frequent concern of mine. Jennifer?
Oh, absolutely. So even when works are still in copyright, there's a special provision in the Copyright Act that allows you to make fair uses of them for certain purposes. It's a flexible test. And so contrary to some public belief, there's not a hard and fast rule that says you can use one sentence or you can use two sentences or you can use 30 seconds. It's meant to be flexible so it can embrace uses, but that can be frustrating for users like your listener because it's not entirely clear what works are fair and what works aren't. Educational uses weigh in favor of fair use. Non-commercial uses weigh in favor of fair use. And we have a free comic book online called Bound by Law, if you Google it, which will describe fair use to you in much more detail. And as James mentioned, it's CC licensed. You can download it for free.
Another public domain track, Harlem Blues by W.C. Handy. As we go to break, we'll get to more of your questions, and we'll talk about one of our favorite holiday films that factors into the history of copyright. Stay close.
Are rent prices leveling off? What's the best job after college? And is our labor market actually healthy? Listen to Planet Money's daily podcast, The Indicator, to find out.
Back now to our conversation with Duke University law professors James Boyle and Jennifer Jenkins. Let's talk about some of the works that have helped to shape the history of copyright and public domain. You may immediately recognize this holiday favorite film.
What is it you want, Barry? What do you want? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down. Hey, that's a pretty good idea. I'll give you the moon, Barry.
I'll take it.
That was Donna Reed and Jimmy Stewart in the 1946 film It's a Wonderful Life. James, this movie is a holiday classic, but there's a little history in terms of the copyright behind It's a Wonderful Life. Tell us about that.
Well, it was surprisingly one of Capra's least successful films commercially when it was initially released. Then it was thought that it had fallen into the public domain because of a failure to renew copyright, which, as we mentioned, you used to have to do. And so TV stations started playing it. Hey, it's free, right? I can play it on Christmas. It becomes a holiday favorite and thus becomes hugely successful. People become accustomed to having this. This is, you know, part of Christmas, part of the holiday season. And then it turns out actually the soundtrack, the spoken the spoken text and the music was not in the public domain, and so it was sort of pulled back into copyright, at least a portion of it was, and so now it's actually commercially extremely successful. This is an example, in other words, of where putting something in the public domain actually made it a commercial success. And I would expect that that will happen to a series of works that we know nothing about today, but which were released because they were from 1923.
I was always taught that there are two entities that you do not monkey around with when it comes to copyright. One is the NFL, ever, not ever, never. And the other has been mentioned by a few of our listeners, including Bar Lennon, who wrote on our website, the1a.org. I've read that Mickey Mouse was going out of copyright and that Disney lobbied to get the extension. Is that true? The term is clearly too long. Is there any pressure to make it shorter or to rescue the orphaned works? Jennifer, I'm guessing that Disney will never, ever release the copyright on Mickey Mouse, A, because it's too valuable, and B, isn't that how Walt Disney got screwed in the first place? His first cartoon, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, he didn't have the rights to it, and so he created Mickey as something that his company would own forever?
Well, they're not going to own the copyright over Mickey Mouse forever. And so Steamboat Willie, the first appearance of Mickey Mouse, is from 1928. So, in fact, it's going into the public domain in 2024. Disney did, in fact, lobby for the copyright term extension that we talked about that added 20 years to the term in 1998. But it's not just Disney. There were a lot of rights holders that lobbied for that term extension. So I don't think we can blame it entirely on Disney. But obviously, they did benefit from the extra 20 years.
Jennifer, we mentioned It's a Wonderful Life. There's another creative work called The Wind Done Gone, which is worth mentioning in this conversation. Tell us about The Wind Done Gone.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So The Wind Done Gone is a beautiful book by an African-American novelist and songwriter named Alice Randall. As the title might have clued you off, it's a revisiting of the iconic novel Gone with the Wind from the slave's perspective. Ms. Randall wrote the book, and to her great surprise, she was hit with a copyright lawsuit from the Mitchell estate. I was lucky enough to be one of the lawyers on that case, and the first thing we asked ourselves is, wait, Gone with the Wind's still under copyright? Yes, it's from 1936, and so the copyright won't expire until 2032. But why did Ms. Randall write the book? Because she said she grew up loving Gone with the Wind, and then as she learned more about history, she wondered about the things that were missing from Gone with the Wind. It's a novel without whippings, without families being sold apart, without free blacks striving for their education, without Frederick Douglass. And so she wrote her book in order to skewer Gone with the Wind for its ahistorical and romanticized depiction of slaveholding society, and all the things I mentioned, they're in her book. Guess what, Joshua? The first court, they banned The Wind Done Gone. They banned selling it. They banned offering it for sale. They banned even advertising the book. They said it was unabated piracy. And happily, the appellate court overturned that ban on fair use and First Amendment grounds. But when works fall into the public domain, what it means is that anybody who wants to revisit a story from the point of view of the marginalized characters, in this case, the slaves in Gone with the Wind, whether it's Alice Randall, whether it's the wide Sargasso Sea in Jane Eyre, whether it's Grendel and Beowulf, it means they can do that without the specter of copyright litigation.
There's also another piece of work, James, that I think a lot of people thought was in the public domain. And if nobody has ever thought about public domain ever, we've all kind of run up against this at some point. And it's the song Happy Birthday. It's the reason why a lot of restaurants used to make up those, you know, goofy other birthday songs that they sing other than Happy Birthday. That was one of those turning points in the way we think of copyright, too.
It was, and probably wrongly so. There's been prolonged litigation about this, and it's fairly clear that
it's in the public domain now.
That it's actually in the public domain now, and that those claims were vastly overblown. And that was part of this permissions culture. The idea that, you know, the waiter standing by your table, you know, couldn't badly sing Happy Birthday. For a lot of people, it's like, wait, copyright law can do that? And that's part of this permissions culture that I was describing. But luckily, in this case, it turns out that that work was in the public domain. Was in the public domain a long time ago, in fact.
Let me get to a few more of your questions and stories before our time is up. Chris from Asheville, North Carolina, shared a story about his father's poetry. Listen.
Hi, my name is Chris Lynn. I'm from Asheville, North Carolina. And my father, Dr. Robert Lynn, is a former college president, journalist, and poet. He wrote a poem a few decades ago in the early 1980s called Cancer is So Limited. And he wrote it for a dear friend of his suffering from cancer at that time. And another friend used it that in a sermon, and another someone picked it up and put it in a book under an anonymous title. So my father's never gotten the copyright or never gotten the attribution and credit for that. He's tried to enforce copyright attribution a little bit more. It was, you know, so widespread and difficult. The poem's everywhere and it's affected millions of people. And I wonder what would have happened if he had actually gotten credit for that.
Yeah, Chris, thank you for sharing your story. And Jennifer, it raises an interesting point that stealing someone's work is not always done maliciously. What does copyright law say about when the information, the provenance of a work is just not known?
Well, one curious feature of copyright law in the U.S. is the exclusive rights of the copyright holder do not include the right of attribution, unlike in other countries where they have what are called moral rights, where one of the rights is attribution. So that surprises a lot of people. If it were up to me, the copyright term would be shorter, but we would have something like a right of attribution so that people could actually get credit for their work, even if they didn't have monetary incentives.
Graham tweeted, I'm a first-time documentary filmmaker and need to use news media footage, video and still images from the 20th century, including some for which is impossible to know who took the original picture, for example. example, how do I stay on the right side of copyright law? Speaking of not always knowing the provenance of something, James, what would you say to Graham?
I would say run, do not walk, to download the comic that we wrote about fair use and documentary film, which is called Bound by Law, which deals with people who are in exactly the situation of your listener, who are being told that they can't get errors and omissions insurance in order to release their films, even when the uses are clearly fair uses. They're using only a small portion. They're using it in order to illustrate another point. They're transforming it. This is not a work that is simply exploiting something, pirating something for pure commercial use. And all of those things redound very strongly on the side of fair use. There's a lot of misinformation on this, and a lot of people look to what happens to big studios who are putting out a film like 12 Monkeys or something like that, get hit with a copyright suit, and everyone's like, oh, wow, those same rules apply to me. Well, actually, the fair use provisions of the Copyright Act were, if they were written for anyone, they were written for documentary film makers. And if you look closely, not everything is legal, but a lot of what you do is legal, and that's where you should start.
By the way, we did tweet out a link to Bound by Law. Our Twitter handle is @1A. You can download it and find it there. Let me get to one more voicemail from a listener, kind of about the way that you navigate these copyright laws. Here is what she left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Kathleen from Minnesota. I published a novel back in 2017 by Doubleday, and I wanted a lot of W.B. Yeats's poetry in it. And luckily, all of Yeats's work came into the public domain just a year before the publication happened. But I would encourage artists to inquire into copyrighted work, because I also had some poetry in the novel that was still copyrighted, and with a little homework and diligence and a nominal fee, I was able to include that poetry as well. So don't let copyright scare you away.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen, for sharing your story. And Jennifer, I kind of like Kathleen's story. It shows that as a creator, it is possible to navigate copyright, navigate public domain. You just kind of have to know what you're dealing with.
Exactly. And I'm glad she was able to get those clearances. But in many cases, you know, there would be estates of poets, famously Robert Frost's estate, who might have said no and might have told her that she could not use that poem in her work. And that's what's happened with a work that's just going into the public domain this year, the beautiful poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. In the past, the Frost estate and the publisher have declined to let people use that work. But when I love your listener's happy story. That's the way things should go.
Yeah, that might be a nice way to end the program. Here is an excerpt of Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening by Robert Frost.
Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near, between the woods and frozen lake, the darkest evening of the year. He gives his harness belt a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark and deep, but I have promises to keep, and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep.
That was Robert Frost reading his poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening. James, before we go, anything you would like to see people do in terms of changing the copyright system? If there's one big change you would love to see more advocacy for, what would that be, briefly?
I think that copyright laws should be made with people in mind. Those people are both artists and they are citizens. And we should actually design the copyright law around the needs of our entire society, not merely a few owners of copyrighted works.
James Boyle and Jennifer Jenkins, law professors at Duke. James, Jennifer, thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Joshua. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for having us.
And closing us out today is Wolverine Blues by Jelly Roll Morton from 1923. This conversation was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about them and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.